13th chapter talks about Kshetra and Kshetrajna. The knower of the field is the Lord Himself. I, as the consciousness sitting within your heart, I, the Lord, am the knower of everything. The relationship between Kshetra, Kshetrajna, and the ego. Kshetra being the field. The world as we know it, the body, mind, and intellect, as we had studied in the earlier verses. All these five elements are the field, the sense organs that perceive the five elements, the mind, the intellect, the body, the vasanas, all of them are the field, and the objects, emotions, and thoughts. So whatever we see and experience in this world, and the equipment we use to experience it, the eyes, the ears, the mind, the intellect, everything is the field. And then who is the knower of the field? Kshetrajna, because this 13th chapter talks about Kshetra and Kshetrajna. The knower of the field is the Lord Himself. Krishna says, I, as the consciousness sitting within your heart, I, the Lord, am the knower of everything. So this consciousness knows my desires, knows my body, my mind, my intellect, whether my body is healthy or unhealthy. My mind is suffering, or my intellect is knowing, my objects of the world it knows, the emotions, the thoughts, all are known by the consciousness. So the world is there, including my body is also, this body is also a field. Body is not the knower, even though I think the body is the knower, but the body is also known to me. The state of my body is known to me, so the body is also known. It's not the knower. The only knower is the consciousness, the Lord within, the, what we here call as Om. But if everything is the field and the Lord is the knower, then why is there so many problems in the world? Why don't I see the Lord? Why don't I experience Him if He is everywhere? And it should be very simple, right? God is there. He knows everything. Then why do I have all these physical problems, mental problems? Why do I have all this stress? Why do I have all these conflicts? Why do I fight with her and then I'm friends with her and she belongs to my race and she belongs to my community? Why all these conflicts between people, between communities, between religions, between nations? And maybe in the future, even between planets, you know, the Earth may be fighting some planet somewhere, you know, in the other solar system. Why all these conflicts? Because of the ego. What we call as the perceiver, feeler, and thinker. The ego is the one that is the cause of all the problems, right? If there was God alone and there was this world, there would be no problem. Because I would see God in everybody. I would see that they are all me. But it is the ego that creates all the problems. And that comes between the field and the knower of the field. The field being the world and the knower being the Lord, arises this entity called ego. Swami Chinmayananda describes this as an unholy wedding. The spirit, which is permanent, which is all-knowing, which is peaceful, which is happy, which is all pervading everything and infinite, and then this body, which is temporary, which is limited, which is suffering, which is subject to death, which is subject to sorrow. So how can this unhappy, miserable, sorrowful body be married to this happy, all, you know, pervading spirit? How does that happen? Because of the ego. The ego is the one that occupies the space, as it were. It's not a physical space, but the ego is what arises in between the body and the spirit, and it is that ego which causes all my problems. Now, how does the ego arise? Does the ego belong to the spirit? Does it belong to the consciousness? It doesn't. Consciousness does not have any ego. Consciousness is one. And it is permanent, and it is all-pervading. My ego is not permanent. It is sometimes there, sometimes it is not there. It is changing. Like I had a child ego, and then I have a youthful ego, then I have an old ego, and then there is a man has a different ego, and a woman has a different ego. Then when I'm happy, my ego is happy. When I'm unhappy, my ego is unhappy. So this changing, fluctuating entity that arises in between the field and the knower of the field is called ego. Now, does it belong to the self? No, it doesn't. Because the self is ever happy, ever peaceful, while the ego is not ever happy, ever peaceful. Does it belong to the body? It doesn't, because the ego is, as I said, the body may remain the same, but the ego will change. One day it's happy, one day it is unhappy. And the ego thinks itself to be the body, but actually is not the body. It is like a ghost entity which arises between the consciousness and the body. Somewhere in between arises this ego which thinks I am the body. Even though this body is known to me, but I start identifying and thinking I am this body. Now, how does the ego get its form? The ego has different forms, right? Her ego is separate from mine. And a dog's ego is different from a cat's ego, is different from a child's ego, from an old person's ego. This different egos gets different forms depending on different bodies. So it takes up this body, it takes up her body, his body, my body, and gets its form from the body and gets its, how does it get life? The ego is itself has no life, but it borrows life from consciousness and form from the body and takes over in the middle. Ego arises and creates all my problems. All my difficulties arise. If I just say I am the consciousness and functioning through this body, and when the body comes time to go, I will leave, then there is no problem. These saints, you know, these Mahatmas, these great prophets and saints, they have no ego. They are one with the self. They know that I am that consciousness. Aham Brahmasmi. I am that consciousness. And this body is an instrument I am using. They have no ego. They don't have any that I love this person or I don't love. They have universal love for all. They identify with all. And they are not the ones. The prophets are not the ones who made different religions and sects and divisions. They just spread the knowledge and they gave it. It is people like you and me that we divided this world into Christians and Muslims and Hindus and then different castes and Brahmins and Kshatriyas and different states and different regions. So all the problems were created by this ego. Now, how do I get rid of this ego? How do we get rid of ego that arises within me, arises from the contact of the consciousness with the body, the marriage of the consciousness with the body. In between arises this ego, so I have to inquire, where did this ego arise from? Some people say, I'm going to do a lot of service. You know, ego says, yeah, go ahead and do a lot of service. That's very good. Because then you will get the ego that, oh, I am doing so much service. You know, I'm helping so many people. That will just fatten me. That's very good. Go ahead. You know, if you do the service with the wrong attitude, or if you start, I go to the temple 7 days a week and I pray to the God, and there is no greater devotee than me. You know, bhakta no koi hai ni. No, I don't see any of you guys coming to the temple as much as I do. Okay, go ahead, you know, do that. Or I'm going to read about the ego, you know. So I read a lot of books. I read Wayne Dyer, and then I read Chinmayananda, and then I read Eckhart Tolle, and then the more I read, the more it fattens my ego. Aha, you know, I'm a great reader. So not that there is anything wrong with reading or going to the temple or serving people. That's very good. But that should be done with the right attitude that the Lord is functioning through me. I am the humble instrument and I am functioning in the world as his instrument. In the 11th chapter, Sri Krishna says that whatever is happening, I am doing it. Just become an instrument. And then your ego will get less than when you do service, when you do puja, when you do read books, your ego will reduce. So through inquiry, you slowly diminish that ego. And that's what we had studied in the values, the 20 values of the Bhagavad Gita that we studied in the 13th chapter. That's why I would request everybody to get these books and read this 13th chapter again, because it has a lot of very good points about the world and how to eliminate the ego. So as you get these values, ahimsa, you know, shantir, arjavam, acharyopasanam, mai ananya bhakti. So as you get devotion to the Lord, as you get, you serve the teacher, as you develop humility, as you develop all these values, slowly your ego gets less and the consciousness becomes more clearer. So the ego is the one that is the problem. So we gradually reduce it through inquiry, through knowledge, through humility, and then you come closer to the truth. So this is in brief a little summary of why this ignorance came. Why did I get this ignorance? So as we had said in the earlier verses, we talked about the field. Then we talked about the technique of practicing the 20 values. And as you practice the 20 values, who is this God becomes clearer. Who is this God? Who is this Atman, the Self, the Brahman? That consciousness, its nature, we have been talking about for the last 2 weeks. And today we will continue about who is this God, what does he do, where does he live, so that I may, through inquiry, reach him. So we are in verse number 16 today, chapter 13, verse number 16. Last week we had talked about the Lord is the one that is in all hands, all feet, all eyes, all nose, all mouth, all instruments function because of his presence. But he himself is not involved, but he just, because of his presence, everything functions. So now Krishna is going to continue to describe this consciousness or Lord some more. So verse number 16. Bahirantascha bhutanam acharam charam evacha sukshmatatvatadvigyeyam durastham chanti kechatat. So bhutanam, among all beings, bahi anta, he is inside, bahir and anta, he is inside and outside all beings, this Lord Brahman, the total consciousness. Acharam charam evacha, it is moving and unmoving. So he says, decide, you know, are you inside or outside? He says, I am both. He says, are you moving or unmoving? He says, I am both. I am moving and unmoving. The Lord says, sukh, and he says, why do we not know him? Why do I not, if God is everywhere, why don't I see him? Sukshma tatvat, because of subtlety, because it is extremely subtle. Tat avigneyam, cannot be known. Durastam cha antike chatata, he is far, far away and he is near. Says, teacher, make up your mind. Please think, is he far or is he near? Tell me one, don't tell me both, don't confuse me. He said, no, he's both. He's far and he's near. He's moving and unmoving. He's inside and outside. But he cannot be known because of subtlety. So let's spend a little time talking about this. Bahirantascha. He's, you know, the Upanishad says, Antar bahishcha tat sarvam vyapta narayana tishthati. God is everywhere. He is inside us, he is outside. He is like space. Where is space? Is it inside the room or outside the room? It is both, inside and outside. It is inside me and outside me. So this consciousness or Lord is there everywhere. There is no place where he is not, and there is nowhere where he does not exist. For a true devotee of the Lord, there is no question of inside and outside, and everywhere he says, I see my beloved. In all beings, even in inanimate objects. That's why he says, acharam charam evacha. He's there in the objects that move and objects that do not move. So moving means all of us. You know, we move and, you know, the animals move, the birds, the fish, they all move. And then rocks do not move. The car, again, it looks like it is moving, but it is moving because of energy which we supply. The car itself is inanimate. So cars or rocks or stones or buildings, they are inanimate objects. So they say the Lord is everywhere. He's there in all beings. And that's why, you know, a saint develops spontaneous love for all, while you and me, we have, you know, we have our favorites and we have our likes and dislikes. Even among children, you know, parents will say, this child is my favorite. And so we do that even amongst our children. So what to talk about, you know, other beings in the world. So another way to look at it, you know, we can understand, okay, a person is walking and talking, God is in there, but a rock that is sitting there for, has been sitting there for 10,000 years or a billion years, how can you say God is there? One point is that Brahman, the consciousness alone, was, and from him came the whole universe. Everything emerged from that one consciousness. So just as from the ocean, when the waves emerge, even though the waves look different, they are all nothing but that one ocean. Second way, what I was thinking about it, that rock, even though it looks inert, it's sitting there doing nothing. But if you analyze the rock, as you know, physicists tell us, that rocks are made, everything, not only rocks, but everything in this world is made of molecules. And what are molecules? Each molecule has millions of atoms. And what is an atom? Atom is a proton and a neutron in the middle. Yes? Yeah. So proton and neutron is in the middle. That's the nucleus of the atom. Very good. And then the electrons are circling it. So even in the rock, there are millions and billions of atoms, which are nothing but proton and neutron in the middle with electron. So there is constant activity. So how does that activity happen? How is it that these electrons are circling? And it's not only in one rock. All the rocks of the world, everywhere in the universe, even the plant, the table, everything that is made up of molecules and atoms. So the Lord is there in all beings, whether moving or unmoving. It is just that the expression is different. Like a plant, even though it is alive, it does not move. It can grow, it can move in the direction of the light. Like they say that in the house also, if the sunlight is coming from the window, the plant will slowly angle itself towards the window to get the maximum sunlight. But the plant cannot move, the animal can move, the bird and the fish can move, but the expression of that consciousness is different depending on the intellect. Like plants have a very rudimentary, minimal intellect, and then it is more developed in animals and birds and fish, and then in humans, finally it reaches the highest. So that one consciousness is there in all beings, whether moving or unmoving. Another way they interpret this verse, Swamiji says, moving and yet unmoving, or unmoving and yet moving. He says, what do you mean unmoving and yet moving? It's not easy to understand that. So again, they give the example of space. Now space, if you ask space to move, where can it move? Can it move anywhere? You tell space, move from here to there. Space will say, I'm already there. Space is there everywhere. So that's why they say that there is some one thing that I can do that God cannot do. There's one thing. Everything else he can do. You know what he cannot do? What I can do? I can move. Like I can move from here. If I get tired of the Bakersfield heat, I can move to the coast. But God cannot move because he's here and he's in the coast. You tell him move, whether he gets tired of the Bakersfield heat, he still cannot move to the coast. So you cannot move where you already are. So that consciousness, which is everywhere, just as space is everywhere, cannot move. There is no place. God is even there in the furthest, you know, in the where space even doesn't go, even trillions of miles beyond, even there. He's there in all the 14 worlds, you know, that God, that consciousness is there in heaven, in the hells, everywhere. So he cannot move, but appears to be moving. How? Like space cannot move, right? You say space cannot move. But say if I have a pot which I close with a cover, and it's a pot space. Now, as I carry the pot, it looks like the space is moving, right? The pot space is moving. Oh, because this, so there was space here and I moved it. Actually, the space does not move. The pot moves in space and the space appears to be moving, but there is no place to move because space is everywhere. So that consciousness, which even extends beyond space, which is even subtler than space, is unmoving, is everywhere, but when you and I walk, we think that the consciousness is moving. The consciousness is walking, but actually we are walking in consciousness. The consciousness does not move because it is already there, because the consciousness is even subtler than space, even extends beyond space. Just as I may be walking in space, and I occupy certain space, right? And there is some space inside me and all that. So I am walking. If the space is not moving, I am moving in space. Is that clear to everybody? Okay. Acharam charamevacha sukshma tatvat tad avigneyam. Avigneyam means cannot be known. What do you mean by cannot be known? You know, now we say God is everywhere, right? God is everywhere. He's there in this table. He's there in space. He's there in him. He says, why didn't somebody see God? Why don't we have an article in the paper? This morning, Sunday morning, God was seen walking in Hart Park. There has never been an article in the paper, right? God was seen, you know, sitting in a restaurant, eating food. No, nobody has seen him. Why? Because it's subtle. Earth is the grossest element, right? We have space, air, fire, water, earth. So earth is the grossest. You can feel it. You can touch it. Like, you know, piece of earth. Now that is gross, right? You can touch it. Then it, suppose there's water. Water is subtler than earth because water flows. Like suppose there is ice. Ice is solid. Now when ice melts and becomes liquid, so the ice which was occupying 2 inches by 2 inches now is occupying a 2 feet area on the ground. Because the water melted and it, you know, made the wet spot. And then after some time, that water evaporates and becomes water vapor. That's even subtler. Now you can't even see it. So what is gross then becomes liquid and then becomes gas. So ice becomes water, becomes vapor. So it is becoming subtler. And as it becomes subtler, it spreads more and its visibility reduces. So similarly, earth is gross and then water is subtle. Earth can be smelt, water can be touched and smelt. And then fire is the next one. Fire can be touched but cannot be smelt and cannot be tasted. Water can be tasted. So fire is subtler. So there is earth, there is water, there is fire. You can see fire, okay, but subtler than fire is air. Air, you can feel it when it's blowing, but you cannot see it. You cannot hold it. You cannot see it. You can feel it, but you cannot taste it. You cannot smell it. You know, again, the air, if it has some smell, it is of some foreign substance. But air itself has no smell, has no taste, has no touch. It can be just felt. You cannot hold it. And subtler than air is space. You can neither touch it, you can neither hold it, you can neither feel it, you can neither smell it, you can neither feel it. So subtler, so space, you say, where is space? Space is everywhere. Air still you can feel because it is blowing. But you say, can you touch space? Can you feel space? No. Space is called Akash. That which accommodates everything else is called Akash, it's called space. So space accommodates everything, accommodates us, accommodates this room, accommodates all the planets and the stars. Everything are accommodated in space. So the subtler it is, the more difficult it is to know. So that consciousness, which we call as Brahman, which we call as the all-pervading reality, even though it takes certain forms, as we had talked about last week, takes the form of Ganpati or Mother Saraswati or Lakshmi or Krishna or Ram or Shiva, those are the forms taken by that consciousness for us to know, but in reality that consciousness is unknowable. What do we mean by unknowable? That means my eyes cannot see it, my body cannot perceive it, my mind cannot think about it, my intellect cannot analyze it. So none of my faculties are capable of knowing this consciousness. They say, then why do they have all these scriptures? Why are we sitting and studying the Bhagavad Gita? Because all these scriptures tell us that our body, mind, and intellect are limited. Our body can only know the objects. Our mind can only feel the emotions. The intellect can only think the thoughts. But to know that consciousness, how do I know it? By quietening the mind, by reducing my vasanas. As I reduce my selfish tendencies, as I reduce my ego, as I reduce my negativities, slowly, slowly the mind becomes quieter. And through meditation, through prayer, through service, as the mind becomes quieter and the vasana pressure reduces, because it is my vasanas, my desires that drive me out into the world of objects to look for happiness, to look for God in the world. But as my mind becomes quieter, my vasanas reduce. As I become more and more saintly, more and more evolved, then slowly I experience God's presence as me, as life. So that is what they say, that he can only be known as your own self, as the life within. So that's why it says it cannot, that's why even Kabir Das Ji also says, na, moko kaha dhunde re bande, don't look for me in the temple or church or mosque. I am in your heart. Just turn towards me and you will know me. And that brings us to the last one. Durastham cha antikech. And he is far, far away and yet he is near. Why do they keep talking in paradox? Why don't they say straight away, Rishis, God is this and God is that? Because as we had talked about last week also, the language of the world cannot describe this truth. By putting these paradoxes, the rishis make us think, okay, who is this God? Where is he? What does he do? How can it be far and near both? How can he be inside and outside both? How can he be moving and unmoving both? So as you start thinking, and that's what they want us to do. They do not want to spoon feed us, you know, okay, you go in. Because then you are not going to learn it. You'll just say, okay, the Rishi said, I believe it. But until you yourself independently sit down and think, and that's what Swami Chinmayananda always says. He says, just because I have said it, don't believe it. Even Krishna himself said in the Bhagavad Gita, I have said it, but you still need to think about it. And if you believe it, you follow. If not, the choice is yours. He does not say that if you don't follow my Bhagavad Gita, you will suffer in hell forever. I will condemn you. None of that. Krishna says, if you follow it, you will benefit. If you don't follow, you will bear the consequence. But nowhere in the Bhagavad Gita, anywhere it is said, thou shalt do it. There is none of that. Bhagavad Gita is a very democratic book. Everything is laid down from chapter 2 to chapter 18. Everything is answered very clearly. Whatever Arjuna asks, Lord says, this is it. Now, yat echasi tata kuru. In the 18th chapter, he says, Now, whatever you wish, you do. I have given you these 17 chapters of knowledge. So that is the purpose of this language of paradox, to make us think. So now what do they mean by it is further than the furthest and nearer than the nearest? Again, we have to use the example of space, because space is the closest to this Brahman, to this consciousness. So space, you say, is space far or is space near? You say, it's far, far away. You know, even the trillion, trillion miles away, so many billion light years, there are stars. It goes beyond that, yeah. But it is within us, right? It is within our brain cells, between our cells. Some people have more space than less. But anyway, so between the cells, it is there, you know, in every, between every cell, even within the cell of my body, even within the atom, like he said, there is space. Because proton and neutron occupy little space, and then electron circle. So there is, in fact, they say there is more space than there is solid in all of us. The space is a lot more than the solid substance. So is space far or is space near? So it's both. It's nearer, the nearest to the nearest, and farther to the farthest. So similarly, this God or consciousness is far, far away, even beyond space, as I said, even in the heavens, even beyond the heavens, Chaudhe Lok, even beyond that, even beyond the hell he extends. And he's the subtlest, closest, you know, in me as life, in every cell. Every cell of my, you know, there are how many? 7 billion cells, and they're all multiplying. Why? Because of the presence of God. Another meaning of far and near, Swami Chinmayananda says it. He says, like, when people sit down and want to study this knowledge, you know, they say, it's too difficult. You know, I have to, you know, first sit and, you know, do service, then I have to do prayer, then I have to read, then I have to meditate. It's too difficult. It's too far. I don't get it. So like one student goes to the teacher and says, after many years, he says, teacher, I don't think I can realize. I cannot realize. So teacher says, look, you need to be positive. You cannot think like that. He said, yeah, I'm positive I can't realize. So it appears very far, you know, and then our scriptures, they say, oh, you know, he sat for 14 years in the Himalayas, in the snow and cold and without moving, and oh, so much tapas he did, and then Shivji appeared or Brahmaji appeared and then blessed him. So we say, it's too difficult, bahut dur hai, it's too hard, maybe next life, you know, or 5 lifetimes from now. The scriptures say he's not far away. He's within you. Why are you getting depressed? He's with you at all times. In fact, he can't leave you even if he wants to. God cannot leave you. Just look within and you'll find him. He's there. Why do you have to? So even though it appears very far, it appears very difficult, he says, khojo hi to turant hi mili hun. Kabir Das ji says, pal bhar ki talash mein. In one moment, all you have to do is say, God, you are with me at all times. And just remember him, and you have found him. There is nothing more to be done. All the other things will happen as your mind becomes purer. See, as you purify your mind, the only thing we have to do is purify our mind. Purify, purify, purify. That is the only thing you have to do. Reduce your anger and jealousy and greed and selfishness and possessiveness and, you know, acquiring and looking and chasing. Reduce that and just start, turn your mind towards God and start developing love and compassion and kindness. And once your mind becomes pure and your vasanas reduce, he's there. He will shine. Just as the window, if it is dirty, you know, you can't see the sun. I've given this example many times. All you have to do is purify the window, clean the window, and the sun will shine. So that's all I have to do. I just have to purify my mind. You will see him inside and out. He's everywhere. It's beautiful verses. It's very, very powerful. Any comments about this? No, Brahman has nowhere to go. Remember we said Brahman has nowhere to go. Brahman is everywhere. There are three entities. One is called body, one is called jiva, and what is called Brahman. The together, all three are required for life. So the body is the one that perishes. And the body, we all have the same human body. Yeah, there are some differences between male and female, young and old, short and tall, black and white. But the body is the same. We all have the heart, lungs, kidneys, all of that. So the body gets burnt or gets buried or perishes. The consciousness, nothing happens to that consciousness. What separates me from you or from her or him or her is the jiva, the individuality. The jiva is a packet of vasanas, mind and intellect. And that separates me from you. Like my desires are different from yours. My emotions are different from yours. My thoughts are different from yours. And each one of us is unique, right? Each one of us has unique desires, unique emotions, unique thoughts. The body, we all have the same. The consciousness, we all have the same. It is this jiva, that individuality, which enters the mother's womb around three months or so. And that is the one that reincarnates. So when they say, I took another birth, the body doesn't take another birth. The body gets burnt. So body cannot take another birth. Where does the body go? The body gets buried or gets burnt. It is this individual which after death, which leaves. And in fact, the people who are intuitive can actually see that they have done that. People have seen that jiva leaving at the time of death. It's like a wisp of smoke or like light which just takes off. So that jiva then goes into the higher or lower worlds depending on my actions, good or bad. If I have done good actions, I may go to the heavens. If I have done bad actions, I go to the hells. And then after a certain amount of time, then it takes another body, suitable body, where its vasanas can be exhausted. And depending on its karmas, whatever karmas I have done in this particular lifetime, whether good or bad, so to most of the karmas I enjoy and suffer right here, but those that I don't, like somebody was a murderer and he died before he could, be executed or put in jail, then such a person will have to take another birth to go through the consequences. So the jiva is the one that leaves. The Brahman doesn't leave. The Brahman is there, but the jiva leaves. The Brahman is now no longer, the Brahman can only reflect in the mind and intellect. The mind and intellect is where the Brahman reflects in the The Brahman does not reflect in the body. The body is too gross. The mind and intellect are subtle where the consciousness reflects and that's how the person comes to take birth. Yes. Yes, yes, yes. In fact, Brahman alone is, but this jiva is an appearance. Yeah, it is separate, yes. Right. So that mind and intellect are pretty much are still there, but very rudimentary. It's like when you give. Jiva is trapped in the body, just as in anesthesia. Now, is the body alive? Yeah, the body is functioning, but the mind and intellect are not. You can cut him, you can do. He doesn't remember. So they are like that. So the mind and intellect are as if put to sleep. But the consciousness is still there. The person is still alive. His cells are still multiplying. He may live in coma for 10 years, but his lungs continue to function, his liver metabolize. As long as you feed him, his liver will continue to work, his kidneys will continue to work.
You can actually put jiva in suspension or any karma.
Right, yeah. A person under...
You're not creating any more karma, but you
are suffering. See, if you are in a coma... And you're in coma for 10 years, that's suffering. That's not joy. Meditation, you are in joy. Meditation, you are in joy. But coma is suffering because you are lying trapped in this body. You can't do anything. You are feeling pain. People are poking you with needles, putting PEG tubes in you and doing all kind of feeding and all that. And it's suffering. It's not suspended anymore. It's suffering. So person is in coma, that jiva is suffering. It's not happy. Anesthesia is different. That's short-lived. But somebody who lives for 8-10 years in coma, that is just pure suffering. That's not joy. You always say, oh, Bhagawan, isko mukti do. You pray for the, that his soul may be. So the soul means this individuality.
So in meditation, the body is kind of, meditation is trying to connect your jiva to the Brahman?
No. What you are doing is you are quietening your mind and intellect. Because it's the activity of the mind and intellect that is a disturbance. So in meditation, when your mind and intellect becomes quiet, then there is no noise. And in that silence, you experience Brahman that is already with you. God is already with us. In meditation, we experience His presence when the mind becomes silent. So you're just trying to quieten in the activity of the mind and intellect. And in that silence, when you turn inwards, you feel that inner peace. That's why we talk about the benefits of meditation. We do have a meditation class every Thursday evening. Some of the people do come, 6:30 to 7:30. And we do talk about the technique of meditation and all that. So if anybody is interested. They call it soul. They call it the soul. But soul can be confusing because sometimes the Atman is also called soul. So that's why you have to know which context, but they call it the soul. You know, his soul left. May his soul rest in peace. Don't you say that when a person dies? You say, may his soul rest in peace. It is that jiva then that, you know, they say, oh, he goes to, lives with Jesus in eternal happiness in heaven. But we say that nobody, there's no eternal happiness in heaven or hell. It's not permanent. Those are temporary. Like if you have done good deeds, you know, you go to heaven. Like if you have done a lot of money, you can go to Hawaii for a week or a month. So heaven is like Hawaii, but for 10,000 years. You know, you can go enjoy for 5,000, 10,000 years. But shine punye martya lokam vishanti. It says in the Bhagavad Gita, once your punyas are exhausted, once your credit card is maxed out, your heaven stays over, then you come back to the earth and continue the journey. So heaven and hell are not the ultimate destination for the soul. The ultimate destination is to merge with Brahman, to become one with him where there is no difference. Actually, even right now we are with him, but we think ourselves to be separate. So when I realize that God and I are one, then that is the final. Realize means I'm saying it, but I don't have that experience. But once you have that final experience, then you become a Swami Chinmayananda or Shankaracharya or Buddha or Jesus. So that final experience is the goal. And then such a person does not need to take birth again. Ego is the perceiver, feeler and thinker. That I am the doer. See, the moment you say, I did it, then immediately the ego gets fattened, you know. I am such a great person. I do so much good for others and nobody appreciates me. And I am so now suffering because, so the moment I comes, then it comes mine, I and mine. You know, this is my house. This is my car. This is my child. And then I develop this possessiveness and then something happens to the car. Oh, my car is broken. I start crying. I get depressed, you know. Or my child doesn't do well, I become so sad. You know, I did so much for my child. I stayed awake all night and taking care of him when he was sick. And now look, he doesn't even call me. He's gone to college and I call him and his phone goes to voicemail. He never answers. We all have gone through that. So then we become miserable. Why? Because this I and mine, if you say it's God's children, I took care of him for 18 years. Now he's gone to college. Now God, you take care of him. I'll only take care of him once a month when he needs the rent, you know, tuition. Otherwise, aside from that, he's not going to call me. That's fine. God, you take care of him. So we have to develop that. So the ego is when it is I, then it comes mine. But when you say everything is his, including this body, everything is his, whatever I'm doing is because of him, then the ego gets less. So ego is the I notion, aham. Aham and then mama, and I and mine. And that's where all the problems arise. And then it is my race and my community and my church and my country and my. And that's where all the problems come. That's where all the fights are, you know, in the religions also, the flight, because my prophet is better than your prophet. So I should destroy your church, and if I can build my temple, you know, all those problems come because of I and mine. No. The self, when we talk about the higher self, consciousness. Occasionally he will say I as jiva or I as the consciousness. So you have to know the context. He might say aham, and then it may be aham as the consciousness or aham as the ego. So you have to know. They're both referred as I, right? I the ego and I the consciousness. But a saint, when he says I, he means I, the totality. He does not see anybody as different. They are all me. But you and I, when we use I, we talk about the little ego. So you have to be, yeah, the context has to be very clear.
Isn't there a group karma or a
group? Yeah, that is the, yeah, the group has its own, yeah, entity, yes. There is a group entity, which is a sum total of all the egos put together, yes. So that becomes the group destiny also, yes. Just as each individual has its own destiny, so the group has its own destiny too. The city has its own destiny. The country has, like at one time, you know, Germany was on top, then they went down, and then Japan was up, and they are going down. America was rising. Now America is down. China and, you know, Korea are coming up. So, yeah, there is a destiny of the country and destiny of the... So there is a total, yes, ego, you can call it. Yeah, the sum total of all the egos put together. The sum total of all our karmas put together decides Bakersfield's karma, decides the U.S. karmas, like that, yes. So we are part of that totality, yes.
Is there a word for that?
Well, in deep sleep, you don't commit any more karmas. You know, you don't do any karmas, but you are still undergoing the, you know, the result of your karmas, like, but yeah, the mind, intellect again goes, just becomes silent. It goes, just becomes silent. You know, the mind, intellect at that moment is not functioning. And for a while it you know, becomes non-existent, you may say, because the mind, intellect activity becomes minimal. You know, only enough to sustain the body. You know, like the autonomic nervous system will work, but the brain waves will reduce significantly. The dream, the mind is very active. No. In fact, dream is disturbing. No. It's the deep sleep that is restful. A dream actually is a disturbance. In fact, they say I had a dreamless sleep. That is very good. So dream, you only dream when you are about to wake up. Or as you are going into deep sleep, you have a REM phase. And also when, that's why most of the dreams you have early in the morning, you've been in deep sleep, and then as you are waking up, slowly the dream starts coming, and then you wake up. So no, dream is not restful.
And then we say our dream wake up.
Right. Because when the what happens basically is that after you have had enough sleep, your vasanas, punascha janmantar karma yogat, in Kevalya Upanishad, he says, so eva jiva praviti prabuddha. Again, the individual, having gone to sleep for 6 hours, 7 hours, 8 hours, then now what vasana, the hunger, okay, I have to eat. I need my breakfast. So your vasanas wake you up, because now I need to fulfill, I need to continue my journey. I cannot keep on sleeping. So that's how. And then the dream is the when slowly the mind from deep sleep is coming. So dream is a disturbance. Dream is actually a diarrhea of the mind. It is just thoughts collected from, and people who analyze dreams, I think, are wasting their time. You know, people spend so many years analyzing, because dream has no logic, has no meaning. What it does, it takes some thought from 10 years back, some thought from yesterday, some thought which somebody else had told me, some I watched on TV. So you take all those 4 or 5 ideas and you make a beautiful story which is worthless, which has no meaning at all. So don't waste too much time analyzing your dream. Why did I dream it? It's just a waste. Yeah, because the mind has rested. See, when the mind gets rested, that's why in meditation, Meditation, you come out with your best ideas. Sometimes, you know, when I'm sitting for meditation, which is not good, but I sometimes start thinking about the class and some of the good ideas come in the morning meditation. But yeah, when your mind is quiet in that silence, see, in that silence, you are closer to God. That's why even great musicians, they cannot compose music in the middle of, you know, the Kern County Fair or on Chester Avenue. They go, say, sit down in quietude under a tree or by the river or in their own room. And that's where all the good discoveries come out, you know, all the inventions, all the discoveries, all the science. Authors who are writing, you know, they say, I want to be by myself. They will close their door and they're writing a famous novel or a poetry. It can only come out of silence and solitude. Only when you are by yourself, then only you are, when you are with people, you are with noise. But when you are with yourself and when you are with God, then all the good things happen. That's why there is a lot of value given to solitude and silence. They say practice silence, that for 30 minutes I won't say anything. I'll just be by myself. So practicing that, having some time for solitude and silence is very good. I think somebody else had a question. In deep sleep, you are in ignorance. In deep sleep, you are in ignorance. In meditation, you are awake and still having that same experience of deep sleep. That's why they say 1 hour of meditation is equal to 4 hours or 3 hours of sleep. Because if you can meditate for half an hour, it's like you slept for 2 hours. Because when your mind becomes quiet and you are alert, and at the same time, your mind is quiet. So it is better than sleep, actually. Like Swami Chinmayananda, he used to only sleep 3 hours. He used to work 21 hours a day. How could he do it? Because he was always connected with the self. So he was in meditation 24 hours. When somebody used to ask him, Swamiji, how long should I meditate? He said 24 hours a day. But that does not mean that you sit 24 hours a day, but throughout the day when you are working, you feel the Lord's presence, that I am with him. So you are in meditation when you become one with that, and that is called true meditation. So he was in meditation 24 hours a day, while you and I, you know, we sit for half an hour or an hour and we say we meditated. That's why Swamiji used to say meditating is not a verb, it is a noun. Verb means, okay, I am sitting and meditating, but I am in meditation. I am in meditation at all times. Atman is the consciousness, the self, the higher self, the consciousness, Atman. That's not the jiva, that is the total consciousness. We even though call it Atma and Paramatma, you know, we say Atma and Paramatma, that means God and the individual soul. But in reality, there is only one. We just give a name that, you know, his consciousness and her consciousness, but there is actually only one consciousness. So Atman is the consciousness.
You also call it
Brahman. Brahman, yeah. Brahman is the same. Again, it depends on which context you use it. But generally, when they talk about Atman, they talk about the Brahman, the consciousness. Yes. Vishnu is one aspect of the, you know, there is Brahma, Vishnu, Mahesh. Brahmaji is the creator. Vishnu is the sustainer. And then Shiva is the destroyer that takes us away. So all the gods who appeared, like Ram and Krishna and all, are manifestations of Vishnu. Vishnu is the protector of the universe. But it is that same consciousness has been given three different names, Brahma, Vishnu and Mahesh, or Shiva, like that. Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha, Sarve Santu Niramaya. Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu, Ma Kashchid Dukkha Bhavet. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namah. Hari Om.